So, welcome to lecture 13, lucky 13. Who's superstitious? Who doesn't like the number 13? A couple folk. Hopefully that won't be a problem today, but who knows. So, lecture 13, March 1st. Happy March, if you haven't been so remembered yet. And lecture note page, if I have that right, 113. I think I hit the record button. Masks, mask, mask, masks, 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 masks. Who knows, as of Thursday or maybe Monday, maybe we won't need to mask, but we're still masking. So extra credit number 4 is open, closing Thursday. You know that. Mini test 6 closes tonight. Don't forget mini test 6 because it counts as a 0 if you miss it. Midterm 1 closes tomorrow night at 5 with the last log in at 5 p.m. If you log in at 5, yes, it lets you complete. If you log in at 5:30, you can't because it closed. Questions on that? Yeah. Except for the improbability of it actually allowing you in only 2 minutes. But yes, as long as you're in the system before 5, it will give you the full time, the 80 minutes for a standard time test. Yes, sir. Other questions? How many people have taken it, midterm? Oh, really? Good for you. Webbies? Come on, Webbies. You got to take it too, not just these people. Please. What else? There we go. You know, I'm going to post midterm grades next week based on this stuff, enhanced learning extra credit. The next one's due Friday. You know that. There's the what people have added so far on average to their final course grade, 0.8%. That's nothing yet, but it grows over the 10 of those. Test results, mini test 5 closed last week, average score 88%, and 96% of the students in the course took it. I'm not going to go through all midterm 1. If you don't know about midterm 1 yet, too bad. Go back and look at the other housekeeping slides, but it's coming up. When I last looked earlier today, 110 students had taken it. That's 18% of the total number of students. And the average score was 73.4% with a top score, 98%. Good job, whoever you are. So, and there'll be a curve. Undoubtedly, there'll be a, well, not undoubtedly. If it stays there, I don't need to curve it. But it'll drop, and there'll be a curve. All right, so we can't get away. Of course, in fact, at 5:15 today, there's going to be a live conference in here on this topic, right? Ukraine-Russian situation. So we continue with the idea of understanding the impact of this from a business perspective. So U.S. companies say they're monitoring the impact of the Russian-Ukraine crisis. These post as of last week, because that's how our system works, so I don't know what's happened today. But U.S. businesses are operating in Russia and Ukraine, are putting in place contingency plans as they're reviewing the economic impact of Moscow's attack on its neighbor, which triggered new sanctions from the U.S., U.K., and EU. So the continuing impact of this crest factor on business and planning. Building materials owner, or maker Owens Corning is watching whether its Russian suppliers will reduce deliveries of natural gas amid the Russian-Ukraine conflict. The Toledo, Ohio-based company, yay Ohio, sources natural gas from several distributors in Russia and other European countries. Although Owens Corning hasn't experienced any reduction in energy supplies from Russia yet, the company would look for alternatives in other countries if it did. Owens Corning's, which does business in 33 countries, global marketing, global business, around the world, manufactures fiberglass composites and other construction materials. Food processing company Archer Daniels Midland on Thursday last said its facilities in Ukraine have halted productions or operations in response to security protocols and government guidelines. The Chicago-based company said it's actively monitoring the potential financial impact of the Russian-Ukraine conflict on its business. ADM said it employs 41,000 workers globally, including 630 in the Ukraine and 430 in Russia. Anybody happen to be in the prior class right before this one where we were doing macro econ? Anybody happen to be that class? I didn't get a chance to ask him. So his last commentary, his last slide-ish, were the three factors, banking, the stock market, and bonds. I want to know, and sort of being a smart-ass joke, what happens if your country loses international banking and access to bond funding and whatever, given the situation? I don't think it's a good thing for you. ADM will use the full breadth of our global and integrated supply chain to support the needs of our customers around the world as we manage through this difficult situation. The company has a 50% interest in Aston Foods and Food Ingredients, a Russia-based sweeteners and starches business. So here's your global supply chain being affected. And, of course, it also talks on the when things aren't in a disaster about global partnerships. Paint maker, PPG, where's PPG headquartered? Who knows? But yeah, Pittsburgh. Are you from Pittsburgh? No, you just happen to know that. Good for you. Pittsburgh. Said it is closely monitoring the situation in Russia and Ukraine. We have a presence in Russia, which equates to about 1% of our sales, and a very small presence in the Ukraine with no manufacturing or distribution facilities. By the way, we talked about how do you go international. We talked about global. Their choice was not to get deeply involved in the Ukraine with their manufacturing and distribution. Company last month reported global net sales of $16.8 billion for 2021, up 21% from 2020, so their global business may be affected. The attack on Ukraine threatens European gas supplies, particularly if Russia shuts off its gas in response to Western sanctions meant to punish Moscow. Russia is Europe's largest supplier of gas, crude oil, and coal, so again, global trade being affected by this crisis. On a much different note, Fair Harbor. How many of you guys know the Fair Harbor swimwear line? Fair Harbor? Holy mackerel. I assumed that all the fashion students were going to tell me that they knew all about this. So here's something that's news to you. Fair Harbor launches its first ad campaign touting chafe-free swim trunks. I won't ask how many men have had chafing due to sand in the netting inside their masculine swim trunks, but it's a thing. So Fair Harbor, the fastest growing sustainable swimwear brand, is expanding, moving into women's clothing and introducing its first ever national TV campaign. So here's their growth strategy and their media strategy. The campaign is from Walrus and stars a salty, gritty old sea captain. He's full of horror stories about the bathing suit chafing and ravages of salt, sand, and aggravating mesh on men's private parts. So here they chose a spokesperson. Here's one of their ads. See if you like him or not.
"'Twas sand, salt, and mesh swim trunks they did them in. Oh, the rubbing. That's why I wear Fair Harbor with the soft anti-chafe liner. Every pair is made from plastic bottles to protect the ocean. I can only get so many of them myself, you know. Fair Harbor, world's most comfortable swimwear. Navigate to fairharborclothing.com to learn more."
He's a little goofy for me, but if it gets attention, that's fine to the product. So the campaign focuses primarily on the comfort of the company's fabric, with a slight nod to its sustainability. Its products are made entirely from recycled plastic bottles. "Have you seen what chafing does to a man?" the sea captain asks. "Oh, the rubbing," he laments in another. So here we're talking about the brand's attributes and a bit of social responsibility in marketing. The idea is to introduce Fair Harbor as a family-friendly lifestyle brand. We want to capture people's attention as fun, welcoming, and optimistic. And we wanted to do it with a character that everyone in the family can relate to. So we're getting the consumer's attention with our sea captain. We're building a brand image among a wider community. The company's mission is to help people enjoy the places they love while protecting those places at the same time. Fair Harbor is currently the fastest growing sustainable beachwear company in the U.S. and says that so far it has transformed some 26 million plastic bottles into beachwear. Dehaney says the process starts in China, where a textile factory takes post-consumer plastic bottles, turns them into thread for its Breeze knit fabric. So here is sustainable supply chain partners in marketing. The campaign is airing on national TV, running on ESPN, Food Network, True TV, Vice, and Comedy Central. It also includes out-of-home and radio ads as well. So there's a media strategy. The direct-to-consumer brand also sells its products in Nordstrom, Saks Fifth Avenue, and many specialty retailers, and is expanding its wholesale business. Dehaney believes that the new campaign will boost sales in both physical and digital channels. So here we're seeing a bit about channels of distribution. That's price, product promotion. Place and direct e-commerce and traditional store partnerships. So, and they're rolling out the women's line, I think, next month. So we'll see what happens there. My only concern, how many of, is fashion now talking about this issue of sustainable, the need for sustainable materials, etc.? My only concern with these products, as I, this is not testable part of the course, is that then those plastic threads, eventually they get thrown away, I assume. And then either they're going to deteriorate into microplastics or also sit in a landfill and not go away. So I guess we're getting some gain there, but it still seems like it's a little bit of a problem to me. Anyhow, they don't talk about that. Finally, this appealed to me because we're talking about marketing research. It is a little technical. So it is a little technical. So let's pay attention to this little bit of technical stuff and how it fits into marketing research. So understanding something called advertising currency. Advertisers need to know how many people see their ads on programs, right? That makes sense. In the very old days, that could be done pretty easily, as there was only live television. And Nielsen, how many people know the brand name Nielsen, the company name Nielsen? One person. Well, they're really big in the old days as a key source for this ad measurement data to help marketers know how many eyes would be on a program and on their commercials. Then the DVR comes along, ad skipping became possible, which complicates the measurement. People could now view the program and the ad several days after the live showing. So major media buyers and sellers came together to update the advertising currency idea to the standard known as C3. C3 was linear viewership within 3 days of the live show. That's when they felt that was still important to them. But then consumers, darn them, kept changing. So then they moved it to C7, so days 4, 5, 6, and 7. So it became known as C3, C7. Today, it's even more fragmented. The market's even more fragmented. New devices to view programs on from newer sources, Hulu, Netflix, Amazon. So the question still is, how do we get good measurement of advertising currency? How do I know as a marketer how many people will see my ad, given they can see it live, they can see it in stream, they can see it today, they can see it in 3 days and 7 days? How do I know? That's, of course, a marketing research issue. So while always important, this is especially critical information to have for something called upfronts. Again, a technical term. What are upfronts? Upfronts are when advertisers have a chance to buy ad time on the network upfront before the season begins. So it's this time frame that the TV ad can be sold in bulk to the program, to the network, at a discount. So you need to know that information again as a marketer. Marketers, advertisers need to have data on audience viewership for these shows to decide where to place their efforts. Okay, so that brings us to, as background, the marketing of the news that's current right now. Discovery, the American multinational mass media factual television conglomerate, joins Omicron, Comscore, video app to develop new TV ad currency. So following other TV networks, Discovery Inc., how many of you guys watch shows on Discovery, the fact-based, not your cup of tea, okay, well, I watch it, yeah, you and me sometimes. You must be an older soul. is teaming with third-party measurement companies and a major media agency, Omicron Media Group, in a trial to develop new currencies for advertisers for the upcoming television upfront advertising market. So here's the importance of marketing research, which is our lecture topic of the day. Discovery says it's conducting the testing using data from measurement firms Comscore and VideoAmp and advertisers including AT&T and State Farm. So we're getting the data. Other TV network groups have worked to develop new currencies. NBC Universal has asked nearly 100 measurement companies for proposals, narrowing some potential players to be certified providers of the data, including that of iSpot TV. The measurement company has recently disclosed advertising-related data with Publix Media for the just-completed 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. So who is going to be certified in the industry to give us the set of data that we can trust? Of course, there are vested interests in which programs are claimed to have the greatest ad viewership, right? So we need an honest broker of this information. In the testing efforts late last year, Paramount Global, formerly Viacom CBS, announced it was partnering with media agency Dentsu, along with VideoAmp, for new currency metrics. Last month, Warner Media said it would be developing currency in a similar effort working with Comscore, iSpot TV, and VideoAmp. So here's our research partnerships in a B2B world. This week, the Association of National Advertisers said it asked for proposals from media research suppliers to test alternatives to Nielsen's TV audience measurement service. So here's competition in the marketing research marketplace. In fact, Comcast will let VideoAmp incorporate aggregated set-top box viewership data, DVR data, into its measurement, giving the Nielsen rival a huge new data set for its battle to take share from the industry heavyweight Nielsen. Comcast, which previously has provided set-top box data for Nielsen and Comscore, wants to help more players compete to get innovation in audience measurement given the new world, so competition in this marketplace. So market research, a real thing. It's a real thing when your company wants to develop brands and products and evaluate advertising for the brand, but also in this domain as well. So we pick up with lecture notes, page 113 and page 207 in the textbook, chapter 8, Marketing Research from Customer Insights to Action. So when we left off, we were just getting into this marketing research process. So we're going to agree that we need some research in a company, as a company. And the question is, where do you start? Well, a good place to start is, what are you trying to do? Defining the problem. So that becomes step one. You have to set the objectives for this research project. What are the specific measurable goals for the research and the decision maker? What are we trying to accomplish with this expenditure of valuable time, money, personnel, resources? For example, maybe what we want to do is, gosh, understand what the issues might be. We don't know what they are. It's exploratory research. The simple, old-fashioned way of seeing exploratory research at work is, have you ever seen anywhere a suggestion box where you physically dropped in a suggestion? Okay? That's a real basic manual way of seeing what the problems are. I don't even know. Oh, look, they want more potato chips in the potato chip aisle. Okay, I'll think about that, right? So obviously these days we can do that through online feedback, web-based feedback, etc. But here we're just trying to find out, are there problems? What do people think? Do they like us? Don't they like us? Or to understand the relationships better between, well, whatever it might be, between our ads and our customer satisfaction, between our product attributes and use of the product, or determine how to affect an element of interest. This is causal research. What happens if I drop my price 10%? I would like to know. In essence, I'm establishing the price elasticity of my brand with research. What will happen? A causal relationship, yeah? So these are some types of objectives you might have. Now we're going to think about how we're going to do that. We're going to develop the research plan. One set of constraints for any company realistically is how much money you got to spend. Some of this research can be very expensive. And time, how long do you have to get an answer? I did do sales forecasting marketing research for a company a long time ago, and occasionally the VP would come out of his office and come to me, and he wants the sales detail forecast for next year for a particular set of models in the Southeast, but he wants it in 15 minutes. No can do accurately, boss. I can run the entire model for you and work through all the details and get the data and give you an accurate forecast, or I can just bump everything by some percent and tell you that's the number. But I can't do it, you can't have it good and fast. Identify the data that's needed for marketing actions to do what? Well, to achieve your objectives, what you're trying to accomplish. What do you need to know? What do you need to know? I'm always amused when somebody brings me a survey and they ask a bunch of personal questions. What's your religious preference? What's your gender preference? What's your age? And I say, if you knew this data, would it help you do whatever you want to do? I don't know. Well, then what are you asking it for? What are you bothering people for? It's not going to affect anything. If you have a good reason for it, of course, collect it. Determine how to collect the data that you're going to collect to satisfy your objectives. So we talk about sampling. How many people have heard of probability sampling? That's a thing you know of, probability versus non-probability. Suppose I want you to do a research study for me, and I want you to survey the attitudes of Kent State University about the current Russia-Ukraine crisis, an interesting topical question. And you say, okay, Kent State University students, this topic. Tell you what I'll do. I'll create a little survey. I'll take it down here to, what's that plaza down here called? Risman Plaza. And I'll stand there at noon, and I'll stop every 10th person that comes through that plaza, and I'll give them the survey. And I'll have a nice probability random sample of the Kent State University student population. So how many people feel, yeah, that's a random sample? That's a good way to go. How many people think that's not a random sample? It's not a good way to go. Can you tell me why you don't think it's a random sample? Because how many of you are never in Risman Plaza at noon on a today? You can't be sampled. In order to be part of a random sample, everyone of your population of interest has to have a known and equal probability of being selected. If you said to me, give me a list of all 25,000 students on the Kent campus, and I'll select every 100th one, randomize the order of the list, then you have each person having a known and equal probability being selected and a true random sample. Why does it matter? It matters in terms of being able to make statistical inferences about the end results. The opposite of this is a non-probability sample or a convenience sample, which we do all the time in marketing, because it's not always practical to find the entire population we're interested in and do a true random sample. But then as a manager, you have to know which kind of sample was done. You have to know whether or not you can rely on the results from a statistically valid viewpoint. When we do political sampling, you often see at the bottom of the thing, this is the answer, plus or minus 3%. If they've done their survey accurately, they're saying that that number of people who favor law A is at 43%, but it could be as low as 40% or as high as 46%, plus or minus, and they know that because they've done a probability sample. So if we're going to collect the relevant information, we can choose one of two types of data. We can either use secondary data or primary data. Confusing to me as a young student, you would always do secondary data first. Seems like if it's secondary, you would do it second. But secondary data you would do first, then you'd follow it with primary data. So what is secondary data? Secondary data include facts and figures already recorded on a different population, a different target market, at a different time, for a different problem. What in the world would you ever want secondary data for? It's on a different problem, a different time, a different student, a different population. Why would you want that? So what?
See the statistical change of
both? You could, if it was a random probability sample and there was a statistical thing, you could see if there was a statistical change over some time period, maybe. Why else would you want to use data that was previously collected? To let you know what the earlier results were, and it might be, go ahead before I answer.
To do less work.
You need to have that answer for me in 15 minutes. You can't go out and do a survey. You best get over to the existing resources, see what's already there, and get me an answer, because I need it now. I don't have the time. So it might provide good enough data, good enough information, knowing, of course, you'd write that it's based on data that's 5 years old. By the way, how often do they run the U.S. Census? Every 10 years, they take a year or two to get it out. It's always old. And yet we use it for a lot of decision making, though it's never current. It's secondary existing data that's good enough. Tells us, or we can see changes. What else was my point there? Secondary data might be good enough, might give us an answer given our time. So where might we get secondary data to see where we stand? Well, lots of different places. Inside our company, we probably have a lot of potential secondary data. We have existing financial statements, research reports, files, customer letters, sales calls reports, customer lists, which might begin to give us information on here's where we stand, last time we did it, here's good enough information to just move forward. Or we might get this secondary data outside the firm, the U.S. Census report. Trade association studies, often, as I've said before, that's what we quote in marketing in the news, usually, some trade association study, or magazines, business periodicals, internet-based reports. So we're going to do the secondary data. It's available. It's inexpensive. It gives us a baseline to consider what's going on. It might be good enough. Then, with that as a foundation, you can turn to primary data. What is primary data? Primary data are the facts and figures collected now for the project in real time. But they take a long time, often. They're expensive, often, to do. We might use observational data. So in a B2C world, we might go and watch people We can watch them mechanically. We can watch them with electronics. We can watch them in person. And in a B2B world, we can go into that store where our product's being sold and observe how people are interacting with our brand. We can go into that manufacturing plant and observe how the operators are using our machine oil or whatever. So we can watch people. Or we can go and ask them. We can do questionnaire data. Ask people stuff. If we're early on in the research project, maybe we're going to use them to generate ideas. We're going to do in-depth interviews. We're going to do first focus group studies. Or if it's later on in the research process, we might have questionnaires, ask people to evaluate the ideas we came up with by mail, online, telephone, in personal surveys, etc. Eventually, we'll hear from our friend over at Protégé, our market research guy, will talk to us about doing mall intercept questionnaire data. So in the old days when there were malls and people went to them, periodically you'd be stopped. There'd be somebody there with a clipboard and they'd stop you and ask you a question to answer a survey. Non-probability, but still they're trying to get real data in real time by asking people stuff. He'll mention that in a little bit.
I guess we do market research both.
So this is the B2B world, and this is Muller talking to us about research over in the world of his varying.
I guess we do market research both ways. We have people in market manager positions. That's their full-time job, is to, for the market they're assigned to, their job is to go understand that market, the trends in the industry, what do customers want, and that's really where a lot of the ideas for new product innovation comes from. We also, though, will use outside firms for, I'll say, the really big jobs. And an example of that would be understanding the wind energy market, which is a, you know, an emerging market where if you're a gear drive manufacturer, a bearing manufacturer, it's really in the news today. And the wind energy market is so huge and it's so different in every country. That's an example where we've hired an outside company that does market research. That's their livelihood. And they can do a faster job and a more global job than we can,
and the results suggested the future role for Timken in this wind farm field. So if you're just going to do a survey of your current customers for satisfaction, your own in-house survey research group could do that. But those folks sitting in Canton, Ohio, probably don't have a good handle on the global market for wind energy. So you can hire outside your organization to get this primary data collected. So secondary data backing up a step, already existing, right? Advantages, well, it's fast. It's there right now, or at least you can pull it up from the library or the internet pretty quickly. Inexpensive, maybe you have to pay for a research report, but still. It may provide a good enough solution, which we just talked about, or it may point the direction for your necessary primary research, because we need something more current. On the other hand, by definition, it's always going to be out of date. A month, a year, 2 years out of date. It's never going to be current. The sample that they use, or the definitions of terms they use, or the categories they score the research by may not be appropriate for what you need. And in most cases, it's not specific enough to your particular research topic of interest, right? So there are limitations here. It just depends on your particular situation. Primary data, obviously, pretty strong advantages. It focuses on your specific problem at hand, and it's under your control. But most of them are costly. Most of them take a good amount of time. You aren't going to have that answer in 15 minutes for the meeting that you're in. It's just not going to happen. So here is our friend talking about research at Protégé.
Way before my time in market research, you know, they were doing mall intercepts. They were calling people on the phone. They were just really talking to people, you know, how we normally would, or even like doing mail-in surveys. Then in the early 2000s, everything navigated to being online. And so we saw a big uptick in online quant-to-qual work. Even still have some in-person shops coming to us today saying, hey, now we can't do that. And in order for our business to stay relevant, we're having to adopt to Zoom calls. So still kind of having that face-to-face aspect, but doing it online. But that was all self-reported data. So where this is continuing to navigate to is online work, because of course it's more efficient and cost-effective to conduct online research than, say, fly a team to, you know, Minnesota to go to a specific mall and try to intercept people. So that is still very important, but we also want to have verified data as much as possible. So a lot of investments for Protégé is going towards verified data. The way that we do that is looking at behavioral data and also shopping data. But with behavioral data, that is using a browser extension. So you might be using a web browser extension for, you know, say like Honey. That's a big one that people use for coupons, or RetailMeNot, another big one for coupons. We have something similar for our members. But additionally, what that's doing and what they've consented to in order to earn rewards is that we can track the websites that they're going to. And so we can tell if one of our members is going to Amazon.com and when they check out. And then from there, we can say, okay, you bought items from Amazon on June 3rd, and then start digging into what they were buying, what took them there, et cetera. With the verified shopping data, that is becoming really valuable as well, because in the CPG and retail space, everybody's doing research at some point in their product life cycle. And so with that shopper data, we're able to see like a longitudinal data set. So this has been 2 years in the making. And so what we're continuing to track and be able to pick out is this survey respondent was going to, you know, Kroger grocery store, for most of 2020, they were buying Coca-Cola, but then why, you know, around the holidays, November and December, why did they switch to Pepsi? And so we've got that verified data. We're not guessing. We're not asking them to report that themselves. We've got it there, cold, raw data. And then our clients can go in and dig out, hey, we noticed these trends. You know, what's going on? Maybe they were having family over, and maybe the family is vehemently against Coca-Cola and they like Pepsi. Who knows? So all in all, it's getting to having verified data so that you can get more granular in the questions that you ask folks. The best way to leverage that shopper data or behavioral data is by saying, we can see that these people were shopping at specific stores within a specific time frame or bought specific items, and then still go do a quant or qual study with them, just knowing that it's verified.
So we can ask people stuff, but people don't remember stuff. People want to be good respondents, so they guess what answer you want them to say. They misremember stuff. Did you ever see an ad for Mark's Manufacturing? Well, sure. Here you get verified data from consumers who agree to have themselves tracked. They earn rewards for it. And so when you run that new ad campaign for your new kumquat-flavored ding-dongs, you can see whether or not there was a bump in their actual behavior in terms of what they actually did. So a nice collection of real-time data that's verified, and you aren't just asking people for their opinion or to remember something or to do a survey. It's only 4 words. Okay, we good? Yes? All right, Fender guitars. You say you have a couple Fender guitars? All right, so a survey of a representative sample of guitar players in the US and the UK found that women account for 50% of all beginner and aspirational players of guitars. How many guys play guitar? One. Women? Any women players? One and one. Well, we're right there, 50-50. And the instrument maker is adjusting its marketing focus accordingly. So here we see a couple of Fender ads with women in it, although the one on the left looks like it must be old. Is that a new ad? I don't know. So 2020 saw an astronomical spike in the popularity of the guitar. This increase in demand is unprecedented and keeps growing steadily. For some context, during the height of the 2009 financial crisis, guitar sales plummeted, reaching as low as $821 million in the U.S. Despite slow and steady growth in the sales since then, many thought that the guitar was on its way out. However, with the COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting global lockdown, interest in this instrument has grown rapidly. Guitar sales increased by 15% from 2019 to 2020, with online retailers amassing the bulk of these sales. That is thanks to a recent wave of beginner guitarists, with the majority of them picking up the acoustic guitar. Top brands like Fender have experienced record sales, and so have retailers like Guitar Center and Sweetwater. Historically, the guitar-playing universe used to be dominated by men, but roughly 45% of those, according to recent research, of those who started playing guitar in 2020 are female. So they do research, they change their marketing campaign, they include the, quote, new segment, women, in their ad campaigns, right? An interesting source of secondary data is called syndicated services. In fact, when I show you research reports that are part of Marketing the News, I'm not actually going out and spending money to buy those. These are reported in general for the industry, for the trade, for writers in that area. And if you're a part of this syndication, you have the real reports. You've spent money to get the details. So, syndicated research is conducted by a market research firm in an area that may be of interest to multiple companies or organizations within a particular industry. The market research firm leverages its industry expertise and experience to determine the subject and the scope of the study, including the questions asked, the populations targeted, the offers, and then they offer their results and analysis to multiple clients out there, both those that have already paid and those who might be interested in it as well. So what are benefits of this? There's cost efficiency here, right? Because the same research results are purchased by several companies out there, the cost of performing the research is spread out among those companies. So that's a good thing from a cost viewpoint. Investing in syndicated research is often a cost-effective solution for firms seeking to gain valuable market insight. The company that I belong to the American Gas Association, because we manufactured, among other things, gas ranges, and we would get regular reports about the state of the gas range appliance industry, because we were part of that syndication. And I think we also got a report from the electric as well. Overview of the market provides a clear representation of the players in the market, whether they are customers, clients, or businesses. So that's a good thing for us to have. We often don't know what's going on in that bid bag world outside our manufacturing doors. What's happening out there? Identifies industry trends. It's useful for organizations looking to understand the market landscape and their position in it. How are those crest factors going on? How are they changing? How will they impact our consumers, our competition, our industry? Measuring brand awareness, strength, and perceptions. It allows multiple companies who invest in syndicated research to see how their brands and product offerings are viewed among customers and potential customers compared to those of their competitors. Offers competitive intelligence. It provides information on how to best position your company in a competitive market. So it seems like there's some useful stuff coming out of this source of secondary data, secondary research. Syndicated sources can be classified based on the unit of measurement, B2C on the left-hand side, so households or consumers, B2B on the right-hand side, institutions. Household consumer data can be obtained from surveys, having what's called a diary panel, having a group of consumers who agree over time to fill out forms physically or online, or electronic scanner services. How many of you guys have a grocery rewards card, like Acme card or whatever? Well, yeah, sometimes they give you 20 cents off whatever you're buying, but every time you swipe that card, you know what they're doing, yes? They're collecting data on how many kumquat-flavored ding-dongs you bought, whether you bought them with Pepsi or you didn't buy them with Pepsi, what time of day you shop, how you pay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They don't care about you as an individual. They care about everybody in this market area, everybody where this ad was run. They care about trends that are changing, et cetera, right? So you are giving up your data. We know about it in the electronic world of web browsing. Every time you swipe one of those cards, they're collecting information from you. Institutional data, the B2B world, is obtained from retailers, wholesalers, industrial firms like manufacturers to provide information on what's going on in the marketplace. So if we visualize this for the visual learners, here's our household and consumer surveys on the left-hand side. So we might do psychographic research. We might do lifestyle research. Who are these people? How do they live their lives? Are they the... What were some of our categories in our VALS things? Are they the exciting, active folks? Are they the believers? General surveys, advertising evaluation as a survey, or electronic whatever. Panels, What are you purchasing? What media are you watching? Electronic scanner services to track volume, to see what you're buying in particular, and to see if we happen to be running in a different ads in different segments of a cable TV area, Akron, Kent, Stowe, maybe they're getting different ads, what's going on with our results. In the B2B world, for institutions, we can be doing audits of retailers and wholesalers to see their volume, to see their inventory, to see what, you know, how that's going. Or industrial firm research, where we might just ask them, survey them, or clip information about them from business journals, from the Wall Street Journal, or go through their corporate reports for all kinds of interesting information that might be part of our research. You know that there are a bunch of internet databases that are out there useful to marketers that can be inexpensive and provide good information. LexisNexis, ProQuest, Wall Street Journal has statistical and financial data available, as does CNBC. There's something called Investors, Fox Business, and then just doing stuff with Google or the USAGov website can provide interesting, useful databases for you. All right, so primary data examples. Mechanical observation. So Nielsen, we just talked about them before. For a long time, depended on diaries. You would fill out a form every day. Every person watching TV, when people watch TV, would fill out a form. What are you watching? There was an inordinate number of people watching educational shows, news shows. Nobody's watching South Park, if you know what I'm saying. So that wasn't the best possible way to go. Then they got boxes, mechanical devices, that would record what you were watching. And I think eventually they were able to record who was in the room, but observational data. TiVo and other set-top boxes, not owned by Nielsen, you know, they know what you watch, when you watch it. Did you rewind it to watch that interesting part three or four times? Did you skip over the commercial? Did you go back and see the commercial? They know all that. Web cookies are a form of mechanical observation as well. Personal observation. Anybody ever work in a retail place where you knew they had mystery shoppers, or they told you they did? One, two, three, four, okay. And did they reward you if you were mystery shopped and things were okay? Did that ever happen to anyone? No, we don't know. It did happen. Thank you. I'm glad we did something good with it. So mystery shoppers are a way for your store to see whether or not you're carrying out their mission in a good way. You can actually sign up to be a mystery shopper. So here is Secret Shoppers, Actionable Intelligence Delivered. Measure what matters, the premier mystery shopping company. Drive exceptional bottom line performance through insightful, actionable marketing intelligence, marketing research. So the cutting edge customer experience company, Secret Shopper. Get real time information on what's really happening by observation. Videotaping. This is an example of a, quote, videotape, a digital recording, I'm sure, that shows a heat map of how people walk through this store. The really hot areas, the red, are where people stopped, picked up a product, looked at the product, maybe bought the product. And the blue are where people just blew by whatever was on the shelf. If you are a retailer, could that be important for you to know? If you are a marketer of a brand sitting on the right-hand shelf, would you want to know that? Yes and yes, of course. This can get tacky. Let me see, do I have it? No. This can get tacky. You have to use a little common sense in this research. Who's being recorded and how's it's going to be used? Fashion students know in general, women know in particular, I think, that oftentimes women cannot fit bras properly. It's an issue. It's a known issue. They actually have seminars at some department stores for bra fitting. But one bra manufacturer decided to record women as they were trying on bras and then use that data without telling the women they were being recorded. You can see a slight ethical dilemma, or not dilemma, problem in doing that. So you got to use a little sense when you're recording people. What are you recording? How's it being used, et cetera, right? So yes, but do it in an appropriate ethical way. Nobody cares about you video them as they walk up and down the aisles of a grocery store. Ethnographic research. We'll see an example of this when we talk about an older video called The Merchants of Cool. But the point is you go and you stay with your consumer through a day. You investigate them in their home habitat as they think about your products or use your products. Much later on, we'll Fred Hunt from Sherman Williams talking about how they followed a bunch of customers around as they bought paint and paint cans, ethnographic research, really being with your customer, really seeing what happens in their day. So that's another way of doing this, personal observation. Field agent, an interesting concept given technology today, a consumer app for primary data collection. Make money with your iPhone by completing small jobs with field agent. What is it? It's an app that connects clients, marketers, in need of market research data with agents, you guys, who can provide it. App users become the agents, answering survey questions and performing small tasks for cash sums, allowing the client to gather large samples of data through crowdsourcing. We've made it our mission to pay people real money through their iPhone for doing work. We paid over $1.8 million to thousands of agents. So, here you are, a click away from stores, sales, and shoppers anywhere. Field Agents On Demand Retail Success Platform lets you audit stores, drive trial, and connect with shoppers instantly. And there are some folks that are making use of this crowdsourced data collection. All right, how are we going to collect the data? Well, we've alluded to it in a general idea, but one thing you've seen, you've thought about, you know about, is using questionnaires or survey data. We're going to ask questions. What are we going to ask them? Oh, where that is going to come from? Oh, well, so one approach is to begin by doing individual interviews. So, sir, you use a Fender guitar, yes? Yes. Tell me a little bit about your Fender guitar experience. What do you like about it? Don't really. What don't you like about it? How often? Ma'am, same sort of individual interviews, at which time I've done some exploratory research, and I find out that you don't like the fret finish, whatever that means. And so now we see, is this a question that a lot of consumers don't like, the fret finish? I didn't know about that. So we begin with individual interviews is one approach. Or in-depth interviews, I have to study the difference between individual interviews and in-depth interviews, but it's the same idea, getting question ideas from talking to people. Focus groups, anybody? Well, focus group research. Who's been in a focus group? And then I'll tell you what it is. But who's been in a focus group? Nobody? Okay, you have. You think it was a focus group. So in this case, what we do is, instead of talking one-on-one to people, we get small groups, 8 to 10 people in a room. The traditional way of seeing this done is in a room that has a one-way mirror, so the people inside the room see a mirror, and then the marketing folks are sitting there watching the research go on behind this mirror. Sometimes they're phoning in ideas to the moderator. So the moderator has a series of questions they're supposed to be asking, but then within the focus group itself, you're free to take different directions, okay? And so, oh, you would like the frets to be a different color than they are already. Who else in the group have always wanted a different color? Why do you want a different color? Oh, you not only want it to be a different color, you want it to have a different feel. Well, who else likes that? And then we come back to a baseline question. And so it's a flexible way of doing group interviews. When I worked with the microwave company, the same appliance company, this was before we settled pretty much on how microwave panels would work. Did people want buttons that they push, dials that they turn? Did they want things, levers to slide? Believe it or not, we thought about that stuff. So we packed up a bunch of sample displays, drove, we didn't fly, to Chicago, had an airport interview with a bunch of focus groups that came in, and we talked to these groups of people, finding out their opinions about displays for microwave ovens. Focus group research that then we used to explore more deeply with other questions. Fuzzy front end techniques. These are unusual ways to identify new cool trends. I don't know, maybe what I would do is I would have you agree to sign up for a research project. I'd give you some money. I'd ask you to go out and buy some fashion magazines, bring them to your house, and then clip out the interesting things that you thought you'd want to pursue for fashion. Maybe we'd bring those things in and splash them all over a big board and then have a conversation about whatever we were seeing from the fashion magazines. All right? So these could help us generate question ideas for our survey. Then we'd evaluate the ideas that we come up with through personal interviews, telephone, mail or fax surveys, email or internet surveys, or the less and less popular mall intercept survey to begin to get responses to these questionnaire questions that we came up with from our basic initial generation. So what formats might we use? One approach is an open-ended question. So I might say in a survey, if students asked, I would tell them, marketing 25010 is blank. Open-ended. Who knows what you would write in answer to that question? Can you see that this could cause some interesting problems for the researcher trying to code the results of this answer? People write all kinds of different stuff. How are you going to categorize it? What's it going to mean? What's positive? What's negative? Etc. Can be a little tricky. So you could say, well, I don't want to put that much effort into it. I'll have a closed-ended or fixed alternative. Marketing 25010 is outstanding, pretty good, fair, pretty bad, horrible. You can see that the answers now are much easier to work with, right? Would you get the richness of potential answers to the open-ended question? No, the open-ended question might provide you a lot more depth and interesting stuff, but it's harder to work with. So open-ended questions, closed-ended or fixed alternative questions. Dichotomous questions are one of two possible responses. How old are you? Less than 21 years old? 21 or older. Again, less richness, but if that's the only breakpoint that matters, why use anything else? Do you think that Marketing 25010 is a good class for business students? Yes, no. Semantic differential. In this case, given our particular product, our particular brand, what we're trying to get at, we come up with bipolar adjectives that describe the thing of interest. Good, bad, hot, cold, bitter, sweet. And we create a questionnaire with each of those bipolar adjectives. Interest, marketing 25010, interesting, boring, simple, complex, useful, useless, good or bad. And then we score a profile. So for example, here is a profile of students in the class. We also could, of course, score a profile for people who dropped the course. Might look different. We could score a profile for people that aren't in business. We're just getting their impressions, right? So there could be different segments. Or we could score this against some other brand, or in this case, some other class. So compared to thermocalculus, what do you think of that compared to marketing 25010? And we can see there's some discrepancies and some similarities. More important for a brand than for this silliness, right? Likert scale. In a Likert scale, respondents rate their degree of agreement with the statement. So the statement here is, marketing 25010 is a good class. Strongly disagree, disagree, neutral, agree, strongly agree. Obviously, these questions have to be ones that are appropriate given the baseline research you want and your particular goals or objectives. All of the question formats can be useful, but the format needs to match the goal. Also, writing the question can be an art that critically influences the result. So as a person who gets data, as a manager, as a decision maker sometime in the future, you need to ask to see the survey itself to know what the results are coming from. Because sometimes people write biased questions that influence the results. Most truly patriotic Americans prefer to purchase products manufactured in the United States. Do you prefer to manufacture products in the United States? Can you see how that's a little biased to the way it's formed? How many people can say no to that phrase that way? And then the results come out. 90% of our respondents say they prefer products purchased in the United States. Wait a minute. How about an unbiased survey? So we have to be a little careful on how it's formatted. We can collect data through panels, an ongoing group of customers or stores who agreed to provide information to us, by doing experiments so we can carefully control the cause, the stimulus. So we might vary the ad that we show in Akron versus the ad we show in Buffalo, or the price, or the packaging, and then measure the important results, the dependent variable that we're trying to focus on. Are they paying attention to our ad? What do they believe to be true about our product? Do they like us or like the competition? Will they or did they buy our product? Blind taste test is certainly one form of experiment. Apparently I highlighted that. I forget what comes up. This is the ketchup example. So this was a study done to determine the best ketchup. What brands of ketchup come to mind at all? Brands? Heinz? Anything else?
That's it.
That's it? Say again?
I thought I like the smaller, not name brand stuff.
Okay, store brand maybe?
Yeah.
So they did indeed do a blind taste test, just giving people the product. So they did all of these. And here's the way the blind taste test worked, right? You don't know what you're taking, and without labels or marketing, Heinz did not come out on top. With labeling, Heinz came out on top. But without it, people identified the Heinz flavor that influenced the. When we tried just our palates in a blind taste test, the winner was Eddie's Organic, Whole Foods 365, and Heinz came in third place. But if you just ask people, what's the best brand of ketchup? Heinz. Not in a blind taste test. So different forms of research produce different results. And there would be an experiment, huh? Most recognizable, the one that comes to mind, but is it the best? That's the question. Does it taste the best? Test markets, I sort of alluded to that when I talked about experiments. Test markets are usually a form of experiment. So you find two areas, two cities that are pretty much identical on the demographics of interest for a long time, and maybe still today. Akron and Buffalo were too. So you would go to Buffalo and see some products in the stores there that weren't in Akron. Why? It's Buffalo. Why? Well, they were doing a test market. Or it'd be in Buffalo with one flavor, one price, one bottle, and in Akron with a different one, because they were test marketing the results. We can engage in social listening. So marketers can track their social media platforms for mentions and conversations related to their brand, and then analyze them for insights to discover opportunities to act. So first you have to monitor the social media channels for mentions of your brand, the competitors, products, keywords related to your business. And then you have to analyze the information for ways to put that, what you learn, into action. It can be something as small as responding to a happy customer, or something as big as shifting your entire brand positioning. And this is just an example of Danone doing it. So, one executive brags to another, I get 300 emails a day. The other says, that's nothing, I get 500 emails a day and 50 voicemails. Unfortunately, there's no punchline, it's not a joke. The reality is that as we try to manage organizations in a global network world, we're increasingly overwhelmed with information and communication. And as the global enterprises become bigger and bigger and the norm, the email strings to make a decision are just getting silly. So we need some new way to navigate through all of this information overload. We need new ways to govern, to measure, to make decisions in this global extended enterprise. Enter the general idea of information systems. Ongoing organized procedures to generate, analyze, disseminate, store, and retrieve information for use in making marketing decisions. In the old days, before the internet and all of that, we had all of our data came out on line printers, cha-chunk, 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 on green and white paper. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And then you'd have information in a stack of paper over there in the corner. So did you get that information? Yeah. Well, what'd you think? I don't know. It's in that stack of paper over there. Now we have the same sort of problem if you don't have good information systems. Did we get the information? Yeah. Where is it? I don't know. It's in the database. But I can't use it. So this is the integral part of getting CIS, IS, IT for business at work. So here's the Intelligent Marketing Enterprise platform. Here's a data warehouse with data from internal sources that we've talked about, external sources that we've talked about. So, customer order, customer data, inventory, sales calls, global sources, trade associations, U.S. Census, Internet of Things, single source services, all in the data warehouse. From the cloud, data storage and cloud computing capabilities and artificial intelligence at work. And then we're providing decision makers with analytical tools to organize, manipulate, analyze, and present data so that we can answer questions like, who's buying? How much are they buying? Why are they buying? When are they buying? From a massive source of data. So we, of course, have now courses on marketing analytics, data analytics, and I think a major in that as well. Data mining is an analytic process that extracts hidden predictive information from large databases to find links between consumer purchasing patterns and marketing actions. Data warehouses can be analyzed the same way as databases, looking for predetermined patterns that you already know about and you want to see if they've played out. But due to its size, it would be a slow and cumbersome process because these data warehouses have become massive in terms of the information they hold. So more advanced statistical techniques and artificial intelligence techniques called data mining allow marketers to identify patterns and meaningful relationships that they didn't even know about, they weren't even aware of, but it's in the data. You know the company Harrah's? Anybody know Harrah's? Yeah? Gambling? Are you a gambler, sir? So gambling and entertainment. So they did an interesting study. Their gamblers have ID cards that they use as they go to various tables and machines that allow them to be tracked in terms of the monies that they spend. So using data from large numbers of data collection, hundreds and thousands of interactions, they generated 90 segments of consumers based on their consumers' gambling behavior, based on how profitable they expected that segment to be, and they use this to determine various promotional packages. For me, the 5-cent machine is a little expensive. They're not giving me big promotional packages. So here is cashing in on customer loyalty and talking about how Harrah's used customer insight data to turn the tables on the gaming industry, successfully using these segments to come up with new promotional packages. Data mining humor. Dogbert, the consultant, says to the pointy-haired boss, you need to data mine to uncover hidden sales trends. Just what we're talking about. Sounds good. If you mine the data hard enough, you can also find messages from God. I'm not sure that's true. Sales to left-handed squirrels are up, and God says your tie doesn't go with that shirt. We have a gigantic database full of customer behavior information. True. Dilbert says, excellent. We can use non-linear math and data mining technology to optimize our retail channels. Excellent. And the point of here, boss, says, if that's the same thing as spam, we're having a good meeting here. We are not. All right, so now we're going to develop our findings using the appropriate techniques based on our experts in data analysis. We're going to analyze the data, and then we're going to present the findings communicated to management in a clear manner to suggest action. Action with our brands, action with our advertisements, action with our distribution channel, action with our pricings, etc. All right, so we're going to take the action as appropriate. We're going to implement the action and then use marketing research to evaluate the results. Did this work out for us? All right, this is, for me, at least a very interesting example. Again, an older example, because these things don't come along all the time, from a study that was actually done, I think, in part to show the evilness of business, but that's not what I use it for, called The Merchants of Cool. It's going to talk about MTV, when MTV was really big. You'll see what I mean in a second. And how they were using this to this research to improve their situation. So first, the credits.
Frontline is made possible by the annual financial support of PBS viewers like you. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Of the five media giants, the coolest conglomerate on the block is Viacom. And Viacom's crown jewel, there on the second floor, is MTV, which last year earned the company $1 billion in profits. A few years ago, when their ratings began to slip,
there was a perception that MTV had lost its way a bit with the young consumer. Ratings were down somewhat. Some of the trend studies said that we were less cool, less creative than before.
So MTV had the humility to realize that cool was not their birthright, that it belongs to kids and kids keep changing. If they wanted to stay cool, they'd have to change right along with them.
MTV felt like we needed to get a closer connection to the audience. Or we said, if we know more about them, know more about their lives, know more about who they are, what they want, what they don't want, we can make a better MTV as a better connection with the audience. if we talked to them and listened to them a lot more.
We immersed ourselves in research about the fall of 97 and have been able to turn that around to where now our rankings, when it comes to creative or original or funky or anything you would care about, musically relevant, have went way, way up, and our ratings are the highest in their history.
The new MTV is all about learning what kids really want and delivering it to them. To ensure that bond stays strong, MTV must understand where teen culture is moving. Market research is the mantra, and its guru is Todd Cunningham.
Some of this music is dead on for exactly what kind of stuff that our audience is going to want. And the research efforts at MTV are certainly legendary. There's been a kind of feverish addiction to research and understanding young people, and that's been embraced from the very top down.
MTV let us in on their techniques. Todd Cunningham told us to meet him at an address in the small town of Island, New Jersey. A short time after we arrived, a black town car pulled up. Cunningham, a former advertising industry executive, emerged with a member of his staff. This little field trip, Cunningham had explained, is called an ethnography study, in which MTV market researchers visit a typical fan in his home.
Hey.
Today, MTV is meeting John, an ordinary kid in every respect, who is carefully screened to make sure he is just that. It is hoped that by studying John in his natural habitat, MTV might gain insight into one of the most valuable segments of their viewing demographic, the teenage male.
I'd love to see, like, clothes. Like, what's your favorite thing you have? What's your favorite shirt?
If I want my sweaters, I want my drawers, if you want to see
what I'm doing. Okay, well, we can look at that in a minute. What else? What are the kind of things you wear usually? Like, what's...
I wear a lot of, like, khaki pants.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And, I have some suits for church or whatever.
We shut the door in their bedrooms and talk to them about issues that they feel like are really important to them. We talk with them about, what it's like to date today, what's like dealing with their parents, what things stress them out the most, what things are like really on the hearts and minds of them and their peers.
I'm just curious about like things with like, you know, obviously if you want, just like with your girlfriend and stuff like that. And I mean, this is, we always just ask these kind of questions about, are you like, how long have you guys been dating?
Since June 1st.
It's captured on video. So we have a camera crew, sound and light crew there. We cut that videotape together, put it to music, edit it in an MTV-style way. We then take that around and show it to various department meetings, share with them the insights that we've learned.
So what happens to all this careful research, all the hours and dollars that MTV spends learning about who our kids really are? When all the tape is reviewed, what portrait of the American teenage male emerges?
The water cooler.
Oh, God! I'm your bumbling!
His critics call him the Mook. That's right, M-O-O-K, Mook. And you can find him almost any hour of the day or night, somewhere on MTV. He's not real, he's a character. Crude, loud, obnoxious, and in your face. He's Tom Green of the Tom Green Show, and he's the daredevils on Jackass who indulge in dignity-defying feats like poo diving.
All right, done. And this is poo diving.
He's those frat boys and their whipped cream bikini girlfriends on MTV's constantly recurring spring break specials. He has migrated to MTV's sister network, Comedy Central, where he's the cartoon cutouts of South Park, or the lads on The Man Show.
The druggies look nice, don't they?
Eat those greens.
So does the whole teenage experience come down to this? Are our boys mooks? Is John a mook? I don't think so. Maybe all that research isn't really about understanding John as a person. It's about understanding John as a customer. I mean, they don't call it human research or people research. They call it market research.
The MTV machine does listen very carefully to children. When corporate revenues depend on being ahead of the curve, you have to listen. You have to know exactly what they want and exactly what they're thinking so that you can give them what you want them to have. It's funny to think that the most advanced form of marketing today comes in the form of a 300-pound body slam. Professional wrestling is the most popular form of entertainment among teenage boys in America. Today, wrestling is sheer spectacle, a magnificently honed lure for the teenage male channel surfer. And where there's pop, there's money. That's why wrestling has been propagated across the entire spectrum of teen media. It's broadcast 15 hours a week on 5 different networks and is seen by 15 million people.
It is huge with our audience at sort of program levels that I could have never imagined. It is the hottest thing going among males 18 to 24 and, in fact, among teen boys. And so we felt like while we don't want that to be the defining element of our business, it was okay to be in the game.
It was simply too big to ignore.
That's what it was.
Wrestling isn't now what it once was. Anybody old enough to remember when wrestling was everywhere, though? It was a major thing. Okay, it's drifted away from that. But how many people still watch South Park? It's still here. How many people know that the Jackasses are coming back with another movie? Okay, it's still here. We are, among a certain segment for consumer behavior, mooks, as defined by here. We like this silly, stupid, disgusting stuff at a certain level. And we spend our money to watch the shows or whatever. Anybody listen to Rover's Morning Glory as a radio show out of Cleveland? Those guys appeal to the mook market with some of their stupid stunts. They're a little obnoxious. That is what...
I remember hearing it like, when I was younger, because I must have just listened to
you,
so
you grew up.
I must have just listened to music on Spotify now, so I don't listen to radio as much.
Gotcha. All right, don't rush out yet. I have 3 more minutes here. So, if you want to know more, marketing research, marketing 35050, or marketing 35061 marketing analytics, or the College of Business data analytics minor. Now you can go. Don't forget mini test 6. Don't forget midterm 1. Please. See you next time.